Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Banana bread, banana bread, banana bread, banana bread.
Yeah, I made oatmeal banana muffins. They're basically banana bread.
There you go. Okay, now. Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. And welcome to another episode of Make Me Smart, already in progress. The show where we connect the dots on all things tech, economics, and culture.
One does wonder. Never mind. Of course you wonder. Anyway, yeah, look, it's us. We're back and we're doing it with you because, as we say around these parts, ain't nobody as smart as all of us.
That's right. We changed it up.
I know.
The bad
grammar version now. I'm going to get some producer
on that. Emails.
Yeah.
Today, we are talking. Somebody's going to be like, there are kids in the car.
I know, right?
Rizdahl. Today, we're going to talk about facial recognition because it's a podcast. See what I did there? Because you can't see us. That joke didn't even make any sense. And when I went ahead and explained it anyway.
Facial recognition funny.
I'm just like, I'm getting the funny part out now because after this, it's all downhill. This is technology, of course, that can make life convenient, safer. There's a whole story in Quartz today about an organization that's using Amazon's AI and facial recognition to rescue children from sex trafficking. There is a lot of potential for good with this technology. There is a lot of potential, however, for major unintended consequences. And these companies are not necessarily being upfront about what they're doing with this tech. In fact, it was maybe just about a year ago now that everyone found out that Amazon had a whole facial recognition subsidiary, which is creepily called Recognition with a K. And we kind of all found out it existed when there were news reports that it had been working with law enforcement in various cities and also apparently selling scanned facial data to other businesses. Now, a similar thing is playing out with airports. You know, airlines and security systems are sort of jamming in iris scanning and facial recognition. But then there was a data breach at Customs and Border Control that exposed potentially thousands of photos of people's faces and on and on.
So, if you look around the world and around this country, well, I was actually formulating a question that I was going to start with our guest, about whom more in a moment, which is why I was slow on the uptake. But look, Chinese are using facial recognition in their camps that they're running for the Uyghurs out in the western part of China. San Francisco just said, no, local law enforcement and civil authorities out here, the city, you may not use it. So, you know, there are repercussions far and wide. And what we're going to do today is we're going to talk to Ryan Mack. He's a senior tech reporter for BuzzFeed. And first of all, Ryan, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So here's my question. And I perhaps I built it up too much, but here's what I want to know about facial recognition software and everybody going bananas about it. So what? So somebody's got a picture of my face.
Sure. You put your face on Facebook and Instagram all the time. It's more of how people are using it. The ability to track you wherever you go. So let's say they have your face. Let's say you're at a McDonald's or an airport or crossing the border, for example. There are entities that can track you with that facial data and know where you are at all times. And I think, like Molly said in the intro, there's a lot of good that can come out of this technology, but there's also a lot of edge cases where there are unintended consequences and kind of things that we should be worried about.
Let's try to break this down into the various component parts, because one of them is government, of course. There's a piece from Friday on Inverse.com saying that something like 640 million photos, the FBI has something like 640 million photos in its facial recognition database. And so there's a lack of oversight of all of that.
All right, hang on. So 640 million is like two times as many people as live in this country. So the FBI has foreigners as well, right? International visitors to this country. Okay, all right, just check.
Looks like it,
okay,
right? And not a lot of oversight.
Yep.
And then you have these companies that are, you know, learning our faces, using them in all these different ways, whether it's because we unlock our phone or we play these games or they're just partnering with law enforcement and we didn't know. And government doesn't seem to be catching up to any of that with any oversight, right? Like, what is this? What is the state of, oh, we should probably worry about facial recognition right now?
I think, people aren't really, haven't really awoken to this as a possibility. I mean, like you said, it's only been a year since there's been a reports about recognition, Amazon's recognition subsidiary, which is in AWS, and its relationships with law enforcement in the country. I think people aren't aware of how pervasive this is. There was this the Border Patrol leak last week that was reported. And I think most people just seem to be unaware of this. We certainly were, at least as reporters. I mean, myself and my colleague Davey Alba really didn't pick this up as a topic of interest until like the last probably 12 months.
So is the theory that by having this facial recognition software and using it, companies and or the authorities writ large will know where we are? Is that the thing?
That's one possibility. I mean, for law enforcement, it's running known suspects through a database and maybe matching that with surveillance footage, for example, or footage they've taken from a Ring doorbell, which is a use case right now. But it remains to be seen. I mean, it's really a kind of a wild west right now with regards to this tech.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's use the ring example. That is that's a really specific case where, you know, neighbors are whether they're in compliance with the terms of service or not, in some cases taking a lot of video of their neighbors and people coming up to the door. That's led to profiling, mistaken identity, you know, police reports. Like, is that a sort of a baby version of what we could start to see at a higher level?
Yeah, there's a lot of things to parse in that, actually, with regards to Ring. And if you actually, we did a story on this last week, where if you go into their terms of service, Ring, a lot of people have Ring. They're these doorbells that record people's faces as they walk up to the door. But they also have an app called, I think, Neighbors. And people post video and images that they've taken through their doorbells to this app. And let's say, have you seen this man in our neighborhood? Or my child's missing. This is the last video we've taken of them through our doorbell. And they posted us on this app. And the terms of service actually allows Ring to license that eternally, which it was mind-boggling to us. Like, it can use that footage for ads, which is the use case that we were seeing last week. Ring was actually using people's footage in ads on Facebook. You kind of think about what the possibilities are if they have that kind of license to do that stuff. I mean, Ring is owned by Amazon. Could Ring footage be used to train facial recognition algorithms? That's certainly a possibility. And I think that's kind of the scary thing right now. And Ring is kind of on the forefront of that.
Okay, so I know I'm coming off here as the what's the harm guy, but let me offer a counter to the Ring use case thing, right? If I am walking down the sidewalk in front of a home that has a Ring doorbell and my image gets captured, or if I walk up to that doorbell, it is functionally the same thing as walking down Fifth Avenue in New York, right? I have no legitimate expectation of privacy. And so if Amazon wants to go stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and take a video and use that in commercials, isn't that the same thing?
It's different. I will say, in the case of Ring, their terms of service also say you're not supposed to aim the camera in a way that can capture the sidewalk. Like, there are technically rules about what you can capture and when. I think what seems to be, though, like a good place to dig in, a potential harm area to dig into, right, is not so much the capturing of your face, but who owns it? Who owns that data after? And that seems to be, you know, with that's great that everybody's got a Ring database, but I'm not sure that I knew if I go up to somebody's doorstep that means that Amazon can store that image of my face forever and put it in a commercial. That feels like a little bit of a bridge too far.
Yeah. It's about who's owning it and how are they protecting it. I mean, let's say this collection of 2 million images gets out into the world and it's used for unintended purposes. I mean, you saw that with the CPB leak last week that they were collecting these images of license plates and people driving through the border. And it just went out into the world. Can't take that back. And so that's another worry, too, for sure.
What are some other worries? Paint, like, the worst-case scenario for me.
Yeah. I mean, the worst-case scenario right now, for me, is playing out in Xinjiang, in the northwest part of China. And it's what's happening with the Uyghur Muslims in that area. The Chinese government is using facial recognition technology to create essentially a surveillance state in parts of that region. So using facial recognition at mosques and local markets and apartment buildings to track where these vulnerable ethnic minorities are moving around every day. And there's a million of them, or more than a million of them now, in these internment camps in the region. And I think that might be the worst case scenario that we see right now.
So then I guess the question is, we feel pretty confident here in the U.S. that that's not going to happen, but I feel like that's not quite true, right? And then when you combine that with, so let's say you've got Amazon's recognition technology. It's being used by law enforcement with very little oversight. We also know this technology isn't that accurate, particularly when it comes to people of color, for example. Like, what starts to be, if the Uyghurs in China is all the way to apocalypse, what starts to be the danger of using that technology here if you're the police?
I think that's, the point with it not working well with minorities here is a big issue. I mean, you think of something like that issue that Google had with its photo recognition matching African Americans to gorillas, for example, which is awful. But yeah, you get a lot of these false positives if the algorithm isn't working correctly or if the algorithm isn't trained on certain minorities. We, for example, ran, or the ACLU ran, images of congressmen and congresswomen through recognition recently and showed that the false positive rate for African-American congressmen was double that of the false positive rate of your white male.
Do you have any sense, speaking of Congress, that there are moves afoot to regulate, you know, other than like San Francisco, right, taking action at a local level, are there moves afoot to regulate this either in terms of development or employment?
I think there's actually been a pretty bipartisan interest in taking a look at this tech. There's currently a Senate bill right now, Commercial Facial Recognition Privacy Act, that's been introduced, and that's to prohibit the use of facial recognition tech without user consent. So basically an opt-in for this tech. But yeah, I think there's been an interest on both sides of the aisle to examine what's going on here. Of course, what's happening in San Francisco, for example, is kind of the most extreme situation where they banned facial recognition outright. But I think lawmakers do recognize the potential for abuse here in this technology.
I mean, with the prevalence of cameras, whether it's phones or, you know, just sort of this ambient surveillance that's constantly happening, like, is it even going to be possible to opt in? Like, I'm just trying to figure out if there's a middle ground between San Francisco saying, nope, none, which feels kind of unrealistic.
Yeah.
And I would like to have some control, GDPR style, over knowing what you collect, how you collect it, and maybe just asking you to delete it.
I don't know how you opt into this tech. I mean, there's currently these pilots being run in airports around the country right now. And in many cases, when you just step into an area, there's like a sign that you read and says, we're using this technology at this point in time. You should be aware of it if you enter this area. And there's an ability to opt out. But I think, I mean, how can you see a sign like that if you're just walking by it, for example? And I think it's consent is a really big issue right now with regards to how these tech companies are using your data. And I just don't see how, let's say you wander into, a McDonald's, for example, that's using facial recognition, and how you click a button to opt in, I don't know, or like an agreement or sign a form. I think it's just, yeah, it's definitely a hard scenario to game out for sure.
I'm reading the Neal Stephenson's new book, in it there is basically a startup that develops headgear that can block that kind of scanning or scanning by virtual reality glasses, which will also eventually have facial recognition built in. It's called Veil. But like you can imagine that that's almost going to be the only way at some point is to just sort of put a mask on. But is that the way forward that we just it's just going to be like a startup cat and mouse?
I don't know. It just feels so dystopian just walking around with a helmet on and a visor covering your face. It's like some kind of Google Glass out of control kind of thing. But yeah, maybe that's the only answer.
Ryan Mack, he's a senior tech reporter at BuzzFeed talking to us about facial recognition technology. Ryan, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time. Good stuff. Complicated topic, man.
Thanks for having me.
Complicated topic. Send us your thoughts, would you, about facial recognition technology, what you think of it, whether you would be willing to trade that privacy thing, really, for being able to get through TSA faster, right? There's a great use case.
And I mean, shouldn't we just acknowledge that I use facial recognition like 160 times a day every time I pick up my phone?
Right.
And it opens, and I'm like, yay, that's amazing.
Hold on, Apple's the good guy, so it's all okay. Oh, no, sorry, never mind.
Oh, okay, right, I forgot about that.
Never mind. Make me smart at marketplace.org is where you send those voicemails. Get them to us, and we'll put you on the pod.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. The shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
And we're back.
Okay.
I did it.
You did it.
Time to fixate. I mean, I have no idea, actually. Like I said, I have no idea what the lag is. It sounded perfect to me, so I'm just going to go with that.
I would, if I were you. I would totally go with that.
Sausage time.
That's right.
All right, it's time for our fixations, even though I'm really mostly just fixated on, like, now what the GDPR says about biometrics and how many faces the FBI has.
There's no way the GDPR doesn't take into account facial recognition and all that stuff. No way.
It does, in fact. There is a whole special category of personal data, and in fact, it says the data can only be processed if the subject has given explicit consent.
Right.
Which is crazy because, like, London is basically blanketed with cameras. It is a surveillance state.
Right.
I want to do a follow-up. Yeah, I'm real curious about how that's working.
The UK is leaving the EU anyway, so the heck with that GDPR thing. Sorry. Crossing the streams there, as it were. Crossing the streams. All right. What's on your mind news-wise, Ms. Wood? You up?
Something trade goes here.
Yeah,
I'm up. I was very interested in this survey that I saw in the Axios newsletter this morning. P.S. Go subscribe to the Make Me Smart newsletter if you haven't already.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's great. It said that according to a new survey by Adobe, most consumers were okay with smart speaker ads. Like 43% of consumers thought, yeah, I'd be fine with smart speaker ads.
So you say, you know, smart speaker play, you know, Rachmaninoff or whatever, and it serves you up an ad for the LA Phil?
I guess so. Huh. And so what I think is that the 43% of consumers who found that smart speaker, who said specifically smart speaker ads are less intrusive, are only saying that because there aren't any ads on smart speakers. Like, I read this and I thought, oh, no. Like, you cannot, this was like a survey, methodology error. How about instead, if you make my Alexa just start playing a bunch of ads, And then you see how you feel about this. Like, I almost feel like the survey needed to include an example of what that would sound like, because let's be clear, like, Amazon doesn't put, there are no ads.
Right.
It's not advertising stuff to you.
Right.
But I increasingly am starting to notice, like, at the end of my flash briefing by a public radio organization that
named. That's so funny. I did that yesterday, and I was like, oh, wow, they put underwriting on the back of that.
Oh, I didn't hear underwriting. I've heard an ad for another program that, like, comes in after the news in a really obnoxious way. And every time I angrily shout, like, skip this, because it is so... And then I hate it when there's, like, listen to more of the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Like, I don't... And we did a story on this a few months ago about how we interviewed this kind of just interesting lawyer who was saying that there used to be this law in the... When door-to-door salesmen were becoming more prevalent... And the law essentially said, like, look, if somebody comes to your house and you're, like, in your curlers and your jammies, you're not, more vulnerable. I always do. You're more vulnerable than you would be if you had, you know, suited up and headed out into the world prepared to engage in commerce.
Yeah.
And so,
in commerce, right, exactly, yes.
Right. And so they put these rules in place, essentially, that said, like, if someone comes to your door and sells you something, you have the right to walk it back. Like, the requirements for forcing you to stick with that purchase are way higher.
Oh, that's interesting.
And this guy, Ryan Kahlo, from the University of Washington, was saying, like, that's the type of law that could apply to future smart speaker advertising, because it's just so ambient, right? It's just so, like, right there where you are. And you just do not want your bathroom mirror all of a sudden being like, I noticed that you had a toothpaste.
Yeah. Oh, please.
Would you like to buy this?
Say it again in that creepy voice.
Would you like to buy this way more expensive kind? It's better for your toothes. Like, it's going to happen.
Yeah,
and I cannot believe that I just can't believe that this survey was being cited at all. It's just like, yeah, no, people really think that. They have no idea what's coming.
Right.
Adpocalypse, people.
Totally true. Adpocalypse. No, that's true. All right. I'm down with that one. That one's good. And I learned something to boot. Look at us. We're learning something.
Winner.
Here's mine. I am, as people may or may not know, I'm a soccer fan, greatly wrapped up in the Women's World Cup that is happening right now. Not that I'm watching right now, France and Nigeria at 7 minutes into their game. but I'm more than a little hung up on this whole pay equity thing. I mean, as a lot of people might know, the U.S. Women's National Team has sued the United States Soccer Federation over unequal pay. And I did this as final on Marketplace last week, you know, in a series of theoretical test matches against international opponents. Women's teams were paid the women individually were paid a maximum of $4,900, maximum of $4,900 per game. The men on average were paid $13,500, right? So the women on average are getting more than twice as much as the women maximum. But that's not the thing I want to talk about right now. What I want to talk about right now is an article in the Wall Street Journal this morning, the first paragraph of which reads like this. In the 3 years after the U.S. women's soccer team won the 2015 World Cup, U.S. women's games generated more total revenue than U.S. men's games. That's according to audited financial reports from the U.S. Soccer Federation. I don't understand how the United States Soccer Federation thinks it's not going to get walloped in this lawsuit that its women's teams have filed. And also, the women are just better. They've won the freaking thing 3 times, so cut it out. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, they're like a national treasure.
Yeah, they're great. And they're super good and motivating, and you go, man, because it's awesome.
Yeah. I will say I recently read about, and in fact, there's a story just from, earlier this month about Ada Hagenberg, who is the
Norwegian.
Arguably the world's best player, and she's Norwegian. Yeah. And she basically said, I'm not playing
for
Norway in the World Cup for the same reason.
Yeah.
So, like, even though it seems like they're so much further, it's not just the U.S.,
right. Right.
It is an appalling worldwide situation.
Totally true. And one can only hope that it gets fixed. So there we go.
Yeah. All right. Giant lawsuit.
Yes.
All right. Okay.
Now, digging into the rest of this.
Speaking of commerce.
Yes. Dear listener.
It's that time of year again. I want there to be phones ringing in the background
and
stuff.
Right?
Like, I actually still get pretty excited about this public radio thing where it's like, you know, dollar for dollar match by the Candida Fund. I don't know if that's true this time, so I should stop talking.
So don't do that. All of which is to say, yes, it is that time.
When we come to you, we're coming to you with our hats in hands, and we're asking you to support the work we do at Make Me Smart, which you can do at marketplace.org/donate.
And there's a little special this year. It's a little special. We, Marketplace, turned 30 years old this past January, 30 years old, which is kind of amazing. So what we're doing and by we, I mean the very good and talented people who come up with ideas for our pledge drives and all that stuff, is we are going back to the year 1989 for our thank you gifts. Think about that for a minute. What were you doing in 1989? Think about that for a second.
No idea.
What might you want? Mm-hmm. What might you want? How about a fanny pack? A marketplace fanny pack? Anybody remember fanny packs? We've got those. Fanny pack is a $60 donation, which is, or $5 a month. But it's this week only, peeps. This week's only. So $60 or $5 a month. That's half off the usual sort of going, concern investment.
Those of you who are watching Make Me Smart on YouTube, and if you're not, you totally should, at the Marketplace APM channel, will know that I am currently holding up the fanny pack. And it is a freaking nice. It has a water bottle holder. And I was just saying the other day that fanny packs are totally back and I can't wait to buy one. And then I got one in the mail and it's the Marketplace one.
What does
and
it say on it?
That's because it goes on your fanny, it says protect your assets.
I love that. I love that. I do, actually. That's my second favorite to the water bottle that said liquid assets. I thought that was better. But anyway.
A good one. I am also currently wearing the sunglasses that
you
get.
How come you get all this? I got nothing. What am I,
and
JoJo the Dog Face Boy?
I'm playing with the Rubik's Cube.
What? I'm literally in the main office. And I've got nothing.
I have all three of them. And you can have all three items with a donation of $120 or $10 a month. And it's this week only. In fact, I'm even holding up a sign. I'm having so much fun over here. A sign with the info that I just gave you. Video is where it's at, but it is limited. Like Kai said, that's this week only. The $120 for all three, Rubik's Cube, fanny pack, and sunglasses, or the fanny pack for $60. And I mean, you guys, you got to get this.
So it's marketplace.org/donate. Once again, it is this week only, please, because none of us is as smart as all of us. You know, that's the name of the game. We need your help. What are you doing? Are you playing the Rubik's Cube while I'm giving the pitch?
I am.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Marketplace.org/donate. You can hook us up.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right.
I'm still wearing the sunglasses, by the way. Last week, we got a little in the weeds about what is a publisher and what is a platform in a good way.
Yeah, I don't think that was bad weedy. I think it was good.
No.
Weedy. Okay.
It was the perfect. It was exactly the type of weedy that our show is supposed to be.
Right.
And we talked about the law that started it all, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and whether it needed to be revisited. And Mikey Carriero sent us this voice memo after listening to the episode.
Hi, Molly and Kai. I'm wondering how Congress is able to pass and enforce a bill like the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act while regulations like Section 230 are still on the books. You'd think the former is holding platforms such as Craigslist accountable at the federal level for certain types of content their users are creating, while Section 230 is there to prevent just that.
Molly Wood, over to you.
Let's see. So what was very interesting about SESTA, which then became FOSTA, is that it carved out this exception.
SESTA is an acronym for...
SESTA is Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act. Yeah, and FOSTA is similar, Protect.
Gotcha.
So what is interesting is that they passed the sex trafficking exception as a narrow carve-out in Section 230, and a lot of critics, and this is where things sometimes get very tricky, right? Because it's one thing to say, well, look, it's about sex trafficking. It has to... warrant an exception, but Section 230 does not protect platforms from running things that are illegal.
Right.
So it's not a blanket immunity if there are illegal ads for sex trafficking on their websites. So critics of this legislation found that it was redundant, but it was actually crafted to be an exception and arguably sort of the first chunk carved out of the broadness that was Section 230.
Right. So it was just to be extra double sure that nobody thinks they can do this, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And it's you know, look, if it was 26 words,
right.
Section 230, this was an attempt to maybe add some of that nuance that we were talking about.
Yep. For sure. Mm-hmm. Becca Weinberg said Section 230 feels a little bit less relevant today with the rise of algorithms. Here she is.
Before, you could say to an editor, you chose this content. Now it's entirely possible for nobody to choose content. but for particular content to have clear advantages, even if it's inflammatory, offensive, or even illegal.
Yeah, but don't people write algorithms? Isn't that the gig? Right?
People
right?
write algorithms. But then they learn things. I mean, what's annoying about the algorithm thing is that the longer these companies continue to try to rely on the algorithm argument, like, oh, well, the algorithm picked it, the more, I think, legislators are going to want to do away with Section 230.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you're coming to me and saying, I have no responsibility whatsoever. A computer is totally in charge. And so forget it. From now on, humans have to be back in the loop and, you know, you won't get a free pass anymore.
Right. Yep.
But the algorithms are bad. Agree. Will Moran of Greenville, South Carolina, said there should be actually a limit on various types of online speech, and he sent us this voice memo.
The U.S. Constitution guarantees our right to free speech. However, the Supreme Court has declared that there are limits on this right, as we are not allowed to yell fire in a crowded theater. How is hate speech, suggesting acts of violence, or deep fake videos on Facebook any different?
Well, so you are allowed to yell fire in a crowded theater if there's a fire in a crowded theater. Right? So, I mean, yeah. Right? And so that's the case here. That's the sort of, you know, corollary here. People are yelling fire, speaking about hate speech on the platforms, and that would be sort of the way into to having a look at those, I believe.
What I think is so interesting is that it sort of specifically says, even if you, Facebook, get in there and monkey with the content to try to make it better, you're still protected by Section 230. So as far as I'm concerned, Section 230 says to these companies, you have no reason whatsoever to come at me and say, like, well, in the interest of promoting all voices, we think that we should moderate as little as possible and whatever, because it's not free speech on these platforms. What did somebody just, one of our producers said the other day, censorship is a tool of government, not companies. They're not, Facebook is not violating your First Amendment right to speech if they take down your anti-Semitic video. Right. Like, it would be fine for them to do that, and they'd still be protected by Section 230, which is why I think that all of their responses are what are so increasingly disingenuous, I guess.
All right, make me smart question time. I think yes, make me smart question time. What is something you thought you knew you later found out you were wrong about? Allison Roman is a food columnist at the New York Times and Bon Appetit. She's also the author of the cookbook Dining In. Her new cookbook, Nothing Fancy, is coming out this fall. We asked her the make me smart question.
Something I thought I knew a lot about was how to write a cookbook. And turns out I didn't know as much as I thought I did. When you're writing and you're editing, it's a very lonely and isolating process. And your editor's really the only one reading your words for so long that this book becomes a secret. And it can be a really lonely process. And I definitely did not know that. I am used to a more communal atmosphere and in a more conversational process. And so that was actually really challenging. But, you know, I think coping, it was interesting. Like, I live alone and I don't go into an office. So I spend a lot of time alone. And I think to counter that, I just started having a lot of people over more often and having dinner parties. And that's kind of what led actually to the second book. I just realized that that's how I was eating. I was using it as a way to socialize.
Oh,
that's kind of nice.
I love that. I mean, yeah. I always knew that, like, writing a book seems awful, but I never thought about it when it's sort of like, and then you're writing about this really fun social thing, which is eating and cooking.
Right.
Wah, wah.
Yeah.
All right. Note to self, never do that.
Totally. Totally.
All right. One more plug for our brand new email newsletter, because it is so delightful. It comes out every Friday, and it will have, I don't know, there could be like stuff in there that we said that didn't make it on the show, but also there will just be all this other interesting stuff that we didn't
It's actually really cool.
Just like,
it's well done.
Super cool. Marketplace.org/newsletters is where you can sign up.
Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Senior producer is Eve Tro. Ben Heathcote and Summer Dunsmore do the video for the website.
This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday. Our theme music was composed by that very same Ben and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves. And the senior vice president and general manager and official End of the Pod Club member is Deborah Clark. She said something along the lines of, you better be scared.
This will be noticed. This is being recorded in your official records.
You better be
scared. Look, we're still here. Come on.
We're fine.
There we go.
I put my Rubik's Cube back together.
I can't believe you
don't
want to
mess it
up.
It's, you know why? It's because my child shot and edited the best unboxing video ever of our Lashwag.
Oh, that's so
funny.
They
want it to happen again.
Oh, that's great.
I don't know. He's at sleepaway camp and he can't do it.
Oh, no.
Well, I might have to borrow like a 12-year-old.
Borrow's a fun kid. Hello, boy.
I'm sure one of his friends is around. Hello. Would you like to be a YouTuber?
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.